This morning, docket number 89355, Stewart v. Nevada Board of Parole Commissioners. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Come on up. Did you want to reserve any time?
3 minutes, please.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Shelley Richter, and I represent Petitioner Tommy Stewart. Tommy Stewart successfully obtained reconsideration of his improper parole denial, but he was worse off for it. The Court should grant writ relief because the Board's action was unlawful for three reasons. First, the plain language of the relevant regulation states the Board is to reconsider whether to grant parole, not reconsider and enlarge the set-off period. Second, applying the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, the regulation should be interpreted as cabining the Board's authority at the reconsideration hearing, because otherwise it would permit unconstitutional action by the Board. And third, this case presents a classic violation of the Pierce Doctrine as applied in the parole setting. So first I'll talk about the plain meaning of the relevant regulation. And that's Nevada Administrative Code 213.524, subsection 5. It explains if a reconsideration application is granted, the Board will, quote, as soon as practicable, schedule a meeting to reconsider whether to grant parole to the prisoner. That is a specific regulation that applies in this scenario, as even the Parole Board seems to acknowledge. And that regulation exists to address a very particular harm. The harm to the parole applicant who was first wrongly denied parole based on a wrong risk assessment. It applied here because Tommy Stewart showed that the Board improperly calculated his risk at the first hearing, and that prejudiced him when it caused him to be denied parole. So the regulation states what the Board is supposed to do, and that is only reconsider whether to switch from a denial of parole to a grant. When language is clear on its face, that is the end of the analysis. As this court has consistently explained in case after case, including in the recent opinion in the Anthony Price case. The fact that there may be perceived public policy downsides to a particular reading doesn't mean that the court ignores that reading if it's correct. There are additional canons that support this reading, including the rule of lenity. This is a parole statute. It's about punishment, and so it should be interpreted in the prisoner's favor, if there's any ambiguity, but again, we don't think there is any ambiguity here.
Counsel, isn't this, what's the relationship, in your opinion, between the set-off date and the Board action? Like when the Board initially denies parole, there's regulations related to how soon they have to set the next hearing, correct?
Yes, that would be NRS ending in .924. So that regulation applies when the Board initially denies parole, and that's when that's triggered. And at that point, the Board has within its discretion the ability to choose a date within 3 years for some applicants and 5 years for other applicants.
And which was it for this applicant?
Because he has a life tail on the kidnapping, it would be within 5 years is what they have discretion to do at the initial hearing. But the reconsideration hearing is different.
Why is it different? Why isn't that just the second hearing? That's an independent hearing, isn't it?
Not under the regulation, because the regulation says the Board is to reconsider the grant. It doesn't say the Board is to reconsider this anew or determine the new set-off period in accordance with this other regulation. It's actually a very limited hearing, because the problem with the first hearing was the risk assessment was wrong. And looking at the statutes, the risk assessment is only relevant to the decision of granting parole or denying parole. The risk assessment isn't relevant to the decision of choosing a set-off date. That, according to the statute, is wholly within the parole board's discretion.
So when they denied parole at the November 21st, 2022 hearing, he was entitled to have another parole hearing set prior to November 21st of 2027. 5 years.
Right. That's their position, yes.
Well, I'm asking you, do you agree with that under the statute?
At the first hearing, they had discretion to set it within 5 years of that first hearing. Correct, yes.
Okay. And currently he has a hearing set for November 1st of 2025.
Yes.
Okay. What, in your mind, what is the wisdom of So they deny it in November of 2022, and then they set it for January of 25. So that's a little over 2 years later. What's the wisdom of that amount of time? Why would the prison want to set it out that amount of time?
The parole board chooses the next date, and my understanding is it has something to do with when they think the applicant might be ready for parole again. So in this case, Mr. Stewart had done quite a bit of programming, had shown a lot, and so the parole board could think in 2 years he's ready. So that's why they would set it, for example, in 2 years to reconsider him again. They don't want to wait 5 years because he's done so much already.
Right. So they want to set it out 2 years and change to give him an opportunity to do some things to be more parole eligible when they come back.
Exactly.
So wouldn't that same logic apply to now we've had a reconsideration hearing in April of 2023, rather than bring him back a year and change from now? Let's set it out again for 2 years and change before we have that new hearing.
I mean, it makes some sense, but it contravenes the regulation that says what they're supposed to do at that hearing, and also has the effect of penalizing him for successfully obtaining this reconsideration hearing. I mean, the fact of the matter is he becomes worse off because he did this. So now he's has 9 more months of parole ineligibility because he explained to the board that they had done his risk assessment wrong the first time. And looking at all the factors, the second time around, everything is the same. The aggravating factors are the same. The mitigating factors are the same. The decision maker is largely the same. The only thing that's changed is he should be in a better position because now the guideline recommendation is for the board to consider him legitimately and not automatically to deny parole. And the board has still not provided an explanation for why this period was extended. The fact that the board's reasons keep changing actually strengthen our argument that there is not a reason for this lengthened period of time. I would also note that the board has not proposed any alternative way to read the regulation NAC 213.524 subsection 5. They haven't proposed any other way of seeing it other than what we have done. And that failure to do so when they had the opportunity to should be considered a concession. And so this court can determine the case solely on the basis of that regulation. The board exceeded its authority under that regulation, and it committed a clear legal error in doing so. Mr. Stewart has no right to an appellate remedy for that, and so he is entitled to mandamus relief.
Counsel, doesn't Pearson, its progeny, suggest that the correction has to come from the outside?
The correction needs to come from some external force, but here the correction came from the executive secretary of the parole board. So it came from Ms. Fraker. It didn't come from the commissioners themselves. I would agree with Your Honor if the commissioners themselves reevaluated, and that would not give rise to these presumption, but here it's different. Here it's the executive secretary sending the case back to the commissioners. So they would have a reason to sort of bridle at having to redo the hearing that they believe they did right the first time, the same way that a sentencing judge could have that feeling when it's sent back by a higher authority, including the court system.
So would your position have been if the new hearing, we'll strike that, if the executive secretary had said there was an error, instead of having a hearing in April of 23, had it in April of 24, that it would, setting the matter a year out then, would be also evidence of vindictiveness? Or he should just have another hearing within 6 months?
Well, I'm not sure, but the regulations that say it needs to be as soon as practicable. So if they're contravening that by setting it a year later, there's definitely problems with that. I'm not sure if I'm responsive to your question, though. So the board's position, I'll talk about some of the board's counter arguments. Yesterday they filed an amended declaration by Ms. Fraker, and that I really think underlines how important it is to consider contemporaneous evidence for the board's actions versus after-the-fact rationalizations. As we can see, after-the-fact rationalizations change. Ms. Fraker's declaration has changed as the litigation position has changed. But reading between the lines, it seems that the board has abandoned or intends to abandon some of the arguments it made in its answering brief, presumably because the reply brief showed that they had no merit. The board's position now seems to be that the change in parole eligibility date was mandated because Tommy Stewart's kidnapping conviction has a life tail. First of all, that's wrong for three reasons. First, it contravenes the administrative code that I've been talking about. But second, it's not responsive to the question at hand. And third, it's wrong under the mandatory parole release statute. It's not responsive because the question here is, what does the contemporaneous objective evidence show was the reason the set-off period was enlarged? So the question isn't, why did they change from saying, from the phrasing of NPR to a date? It's, why did Tommy Stewart get put in a worse position? Why did this length of time get so much longer?
But it got eight months longer, or 9 months longer, and they had just seen him closer in time to the originally scheduled hearing date. Wouldn't it make sense to give him more time? So that's the first question. The second is, was he even eligible for parole at the time that he's having these hearings, given the eight to the board on the kidnapping?
He was eligible for parole because at his first hearing, he had served 8 years, so that was the minimum for the robbery, and his minimum for the kidnapping was 5 years. So the board has always treated the robbery conviction as his controlling sentence because after serving his 8-year robbery minimum, he became eligible and he had his first parole hearing. So he was eligible both for discretionary parole on the kidnapping count and for mandatory parole release on the robbery count. I understand if he's denied discretionary parole on the kidnapping count, he's not going to get mandatory parole because that would go against each other, but he was eligible for both types of parole.
So in 2022, when he had the first hearing, he was already eligible for release.
He was eligible for a release to the streets.
Okay.
And I think Your Honor's first question was, wouldn't it make sense to give him more time because of when this hearing happened? No, it wouldn't. It has the effect of penalizing him. He was going for a reconsideration to try to switch from this denial to a grant. And by adding more time, it had the effect of punishing that action without any explanation.
Is there any period of time that you concede would be sufficiently close to this already scheduled hearing date such that it was okay to move that date?
No, I think the regulation speaks to that question, and it cabins the board's authority at that period. I see I'm in my rebuttal time, so if there's no further questions, I'll reserve. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Senior Deputy Attorney General Laura Ginn, and I represent the respondents in this case. The writ should not issue because Mr. Stewart received the requested rehearing that, and now he seems to want more. He was never objectively eligible for mandatory parole because of his life sentence. When Stewart informed the parole board of the risk change from score from 14 to 13, the parole board promptly responded within that same month of January and scheduled a new hearing for him in April. At the new hearing, there was a new commissioner. Commissioner Bailey expressed concern about Stewart's parole. New testimony was heard and new documents and exhibits were received. The parole board mistakenly relied on an incorrect mandatory parole release date for that January 24, 2025 date. Stewart does not have the due process right to parole. He does have the right to be considered for parole, and the parole board did consider him fully at that in November and then also in April. And there cannot be a presumption of vindictiveness in this case because the objective evidence shows that Stewart was not eligible for mandatory parole and the parole board set off was approximately 2 years, 6 months, and 7 days from the date of the second hearing, and that was even within the 3 years from the first hearing and well within the possible 5 years for his parole. Opposing counsel has not pointed to a statute that requires a set-off be shorter than the previous time or longer. And counsel spoke about NAC 213.524, and that regulation says to reconsider parole, whether to grant parole. It's silent as to how long the set-off time would be. And because it's silent, that falls within the discretion of the parole board. So in the reconsideration letter that was filed with the parole board, the request was to urge this board to reschedule a meeting as soon as possible to reassess whether to give Tommy parole pursuant to the regulation and to grant him parole. Alternatively, she asked the board to set Tommy's parole at a date sooner than January 24, 2025, which signals the fact that she understood that that date could move. She's asking for it alternatively to be moved sooner. It could have been moved, and it was moved later. And regarding the Pierce question that you brought up, in Bowser versus State, this court held the Pierce presumption of vindictiveness does not apply when a different judge imposed a more severe sentence. In this case, there were three of the same commissioners and one different. And the one that was different, Commissioner Bailey, expressed her concerns about his violence when he was let out. And they had a long talk about that. And the other two commissioners also pointed out their concerns about having a plan when he gets out, you know, not falling in with the same crowd and having a mentor and that kind of thing. So it wasn't just a rehearing of the same considerations. The risk score moved from the highest high risk, which means deny parole is the suggestion, to the highest moderate risk, which means consider conditions. And in this case, they did. They had new testimony. They discussed with him his programming. They discussed, you know, what his plans were before he was to be released. So it wasn't just, you know, whether to, it was more complete than just a quick hearing.
Counsel, once there is a hearing, so let's talk about, say, the April hearing, who determines the set-off, how is the set-off date determined at the conclusion of the hearing?
It's within the parole board's discretion, and they decide. When they saw that mandatory parole date, they set it after that. And during the testimony, not only at the first hearing but the second hearing, they double-checked with the Nevada Department of Corrections as to whether that sentence structure was correct, and they said yes. So because it was a discretionary parole hearing, they could set it out for 5 years, is my understanding. Regarding the two statutes, NRS 213.12.13 sub 1 and 213.12.15 sub 1B, the life sentence blocks the eligibility for mandatory parole because he is otherwise ineligible for parole because of the life sentence. So there's no statute requiring a shorter set-off. Mr. Stewart was not and is not eligible for mandatory parole because of his life sentence. And in the writ, the request is to compel the board to find Mr. Stewart's parole eligible as of January 24, 2025, and due to the life sentence, that is not correct. The writ should not issue due to his life sentence.
Counsel, why did the board express why it did move the set-off date?
Because it was based upon the erroneous mandatory parole release date. That's my understanding of why they set that date. And after that second hearing, they realized that that mandatory parole date was incorrect due to the life sentence, and so they set it off a little bit further, still well within the 3 years and not near the five.
And is that reflected in the record somewhere?
That the set-off
was... Conversations with NDOC, is that reflected in the deliberations of the commissioners? How the determination's made to change the set-off date after the April hearing?
It is not. The communications between the parole board and NDOC are not in the record. And when I was speaking with my client yesterday, some of the changes came out, and I had an ethical responsibility when I realized that there was some miscommunication within that declaration and misstatements within that declaration to correct it. I apologize for the timing.
And how does the declaration that was submitted strengthen or weaken the case for the board?
Well, in the first declaration, Your Honor, it said that NDOC corrected the error before the second hearing, and that was incorrect.
Which error?
Oh, I'm sorry. That NDOC corrected the mandatory parole release date prior to the second hearing, and that was incorrect. The other issue that was corrected was that the robbery charge is the correct charge to use for the maximum time he has to stay in prison prior to being eligible for parole. So the robbery carried an 8 to 20 year sentence, and the 8 years should be the benchmark for determining that.
Thank you.
Can you discuss just for a minute Pearson Smith and whether they apply to these particular proceedings?
Pearson Smith do not apply in these particular proceedings because in Pierce and its progeny, one of the considerations is that there's a personal reason for the change. In this case, there is no personal reason. There was a clear change in the commissioners who heard it. The commissioners at the second hearing specifically stated their concerns about his violence and having a plan. And let's see. And that... So under Pierce, you cannot impose a heavier sentence on a reconvicted defendant for the explicit purpose of punishing him. And in this case, you don't see that explicit purpose of punishing him because even at the second hearing, they showed their concerns regarding his violence and having a plan and all of that kind of thing. And then under Alesimo, there's no liberty interest, and because the commissioners changed, because they had a full rehearing, because they had new testimony, it was everything together. It wasn't just because they were trying to protect themselves. There was no protection here because they held that hearing quickly and promptly. They had different commissioners. They fully considered his programming and all the other changes that had happened after that first hearing. So, like I said, the objective evidence shows that there was no vindictiveness in this case.
How important is the fact that the prompt to reconsider came from the executive director as opposed to some external source?
I think it's important, Your Honor, because it shows that the parole board was willing to rectify the error. The letter came in, I believe, around January 4th, and toward the end of January, maybe even the 28th, the letter issued saying, yes, let's have a rehearing.
But as far as Pierce is concerned, what's the distinction that it came from arguably within the board as opposed to externally? And counsel indicated because the executive director made that determination and not the board itself, that it's distinguished.
That the executive director made the distinction to have the second hearing?
Yes, that the rating was incorrect.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to know that she did fix the error. She rectified the error by saying, yes, let's have a rehearing. Importantly, also at the first hearing, the Department of Corrections verified the risk score that they had. Per my recollection from that video, they said this is the sentence structure is this correct, and it was verified at that point.
If I can maybe jump on my colleague's question. I think what counsel was suggesting was that the executive secretary somehow is on an equal playing field, say, with an external rebuke that may come from a judge or an appeals court having to revisit their work. What's the role of the executive secretary? Would that be internal correction, or is that almost an external rebuke of the board's work?
She is not on the board, from my understanding, so to me that would be an external.
Procedurally, when an inmate has a hearing, as was done here in November of 22, and then they have their reconsideration hearing in April of 2023, is the inmate limited to producing at the reconsideration hearing only what he had of benefit to him in November, or is he allowed to produce whatever has occurred over the last 5 to 6 months as well? Let's say he got other certificates, completed other programs, saved another inmate's life in some type of situation. Is he hampered in any way, or can he produce everything as of April 2023 and asking for parole release?
Your Honor, because the exhibits changed, I would imagine that he could add to it, because he did have exhibits in there regarding what programming he did have, but I would have to double check to be 100% sure.
Okay.
But may I?
Yes.
The contemplated rehearing is that it's a new hearing, it's new testimony, and it's, in this instance, new commissioners.
In this hearing, yes, it was.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few points on rebuttal. I don't believe that Ms. Ginn provided a reason why Pierce does not apply in the parole setting. All the cases I've seen, both regarding federal parole hearings and state parole hearings, Pierce does apply. The fact that Anselmo found no liberty interest in being granted parole doesn't change that. It's been black letter law for decades and decades that even when the government has discretion to give or deny a benefit, it can't deny a benefit for constitutionally impermissible reasons. So an example of that is Perry versus Sinderman, a United States Supreme Court case from 1972. The government can't deny benefits out of vindictiveness, out of retaliation. That's been the case forever. In addition, Ms. Ginn discussed that there were different commissioners. Three of the four commissioners were the same. In the cases that I saw, actually, parole was treated a little bit differently than a sentencing judge changing. Parole commissioners were treated as an entity. So First, I don't think a change of one out of four commissioners constitutes a change because the majority is the same. And second, the cases that I've seen talk about commissioners as an entity. In addition, what the commissioners were talking about at the actual reconsideration hearing doesn't say what they were necessarily thinking or what their thought process is. Just as your honors questions don't necessarily tell me what you're thinking, the same is true for the commissioners. Those are just questions meant to get at different answers from the applicant.
So what, the same question I asked counsel, was your client able to present in April of 2023 anything that had occurred between November and April that would have been of benefit to him in asking for parole?
I believe so. I don't see anything that stops him from doing that. Okay. So certainly he can make a perhaps better showing to try to get that grant of parole at that second hearing. If certain things happen that are quite terrible for him, then the parole board isn't prejudiced, then they're back at the denial.
Sure.
So there's really no prejudice to the board.
And what exactly are you asking us to do when you say we would like him to be deemed parole eligible as of January of 2025?
We would ask him to be deemed parole eligible at this point, immediately eligible for discretionary parole on his kidnapping conviction. So he can be.
You're not asking to have another hearing set before November of 2025. You're asking the court to determine that he's eligible to be released?
Eligible for a parole hearing.
Okay.
Right. No, I would not ask the court to order him released.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's my time. If the court has no further questions.
Yes, go ahead.
So, counsel, is it your position that any change in the set-off date is evidence of vindictiveness?
It's the beginning of the analysis. If the set-off date is lengthened and it's in response to a triggering event, then we need to look at what happened and is there any reason that's contemporaneous in the record that supports it. So a lengthening of the set-off date certainly triggers that analysis.
So in this instance, other than the lengthening of the set-off date, is there anything else you'd point to that lends itself to suggest the board acted vindictively in changing the date?
Yes, the timing. The set-off date was lengthened after the executive secretary granted that reconsideration hearing. So it follows on the heels of the reconsideration hearing. In addition, the mitigating factors remain the same, the aggravators remain the same, nothing changed, he had no disciplinary infraction, no victim spoke, the JOC didn't change, everything was the same. And now that the executive secretary has provided two different declarations, the changing explanations for the change are further support that this was reasonably presumed to be vindictive. And that's what we need to show. We need to trigger the reasonable presumption, which we have, and then it goes to them to rebut, which we submit they have not been able to rebut it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel, thank you for the briefing. Matter of